Good evening. This is Heartstock Radio, and I'm your host, Carol Murphy. Thank you for being with us on this beautiful, almost spring day here in Butte, Montana. I noticed when I walked outside today, my yard is kind of a pond more than a yard. It seems the snow is melting, but the ground is still frozen. Interesting combination. Thank you for listening. Our email, so if you know of anybody who'd love to be our guest and is using business as a force for good, they can email us at heartstockradio@gmail.com. You can also find us on Facebook. And today our guest is Lewis Perkins. He's the president at Apparel Impact Institute. He's had a wide and varied career and has a lot to tell us about. In just a moment, Lewis will be with us. This is Heartstock.
And on the sign it said, no trespassing, but on the other side, it didn't say nothing.
That sign was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to New York Island, from the redwood forest to the gold stream waters. This land was made for you and me. This land was made for you and me.
This is Heartstock Radio. I'm your host, Carol Murphy, and our guest today is Lewis Perkins. He is the president of Apparel Impact Institute. Hi, Lewis. Thank you so much for being our guest.
Hi, Carol. How's it going?
It's going very well. We're having a beautiful day here in Montana. It's been quite like below zero cold, so today really feels spring here. Yeah.
Oh, that's great. Well, you're reaching me in Oakland, California, where it's a nice sunny 70 degree day.
Holy moly. Yeah, we'll see that in about 3 months. We'll have some 70 degree days. But can you please tell our listeners just a little bit about yourself and what is Apparel Impact Institute?
Absolutely. So as you introduced, I'm running this organization called the Apparel Impact Institute, and I have been there for the last year and a half. We're in the first 2 years of operation, so I am the inaugural president of the organization. But my background is such that I grew up in the southeastern United States. I grew up in North Florida and was educated in Virginia and Georgia. And about 10 years into my career, I realized that I was really missing purpose. And I sought to find my way back into some level of working, whether it was corporate for-profit or working in nonprofit, that would align towards my own desire to find joy in my daily work. And so over the last 15 years, I've been blessed to be able to work for a series of companies and or nonprofits that are really aligned towards environmental sustainability. And that's kind of what's led me to the launch of this new organization that I'm running now, Apparel Impact Institute.
And why did you choose? I mean, there's so many areas of interest and areas of need. Why apparel for you?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, when I started in the environmental space, my first job was working for an air quality nonprofit called the Clean Air Campaign. And we were a public-private partnership looking at transportation issues and CO2 emissions on coming out of cars on the road. And so I got a real glimpse at sort of a lot of different companies that were working in the metro Atlanta area at the time around air quality. I was not working at all in the apparel sector. There's not really any kind of corporate leadership around apparel in Atlanta, but production and manufacturing oftentimes had happened in the Carolinas and in the Southeast. And from there, I ended up working for the carpet manufacturing company, Mohawk Industries. And what's important to that, that kind of led me into this space, was that it became sort of the seed of my knowledge of textiles. And even though carpet is not necessarily apparel, there's a similarity in terms of the manufacturing process around fibers and yarns and putting together a product that sort of gave me a little bit of knowledge. So that when I came to the Cradle Institute in 2012, I was asked to lead the apparel space. And so I've spent the last, 8 years really focusing in on the impacts of the apparel industry. And so to answer your question, why apparel? Why are we focusing on this area? It is one of several big manufacturing industries that has pretty large negative environmental impact. And when you look at it from the apparel sector, it's around CO2 emissions, greenhouse gas. It's a major contributor to our issues around climate. It's also about water quality and clean available water globally, because it's a major contributor and user of water and chemicals that get back into the water system. And finally, around waste. We produce a really wide, vast amount of waste in the apparel sector, clothing that either never gets worn or has not been designed for anything but a landfill by the time it's, you know, lost its usefulness. So that's the real reason, those kind of three key issues, why apparel not only is a large focus right now of the whole sustainability environmental movement, but why I in particular also felt compelled to continue building upon the early work that I started even in the carpet industry.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that you grew up in Florida. Is that right?
I did.
Were there influences early on that kind of instilled within you the concepts and the ideas that sustainability was important, that would give your life purpose if you were able to have an impact with all of your work?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, you know, when I look back at why the environment, I would have never, especially going back 15, 20 years ago, I would have never called myself an environmentalist or that this was some deep passion. But I grew up in the woods, and I grew up running around, you know, in some acreage behind our house. And I grew up at the beach. We were fortunate enough to have a little cottage on the Gulf of Mexico that we would go to on the weekends. And I observed over the course of my childhood the diminishing availability of certain marine life. You know, the oyster industry was being hurt by the pollutants that were coming through the rivers from Georgia and Alabama into the Gulf of Mexico. There, obviously, in later years, have been some of the oil spills in the Gulf. But I was aware of these things as a child. I can remember walking down the beach and getting tar patches on the bottom of my feet coming from, you know, the oil that was being extruded out so many miles out from us. These were early pieces that I think once I had a connection and relationship to nature, that I wanted to improve upon it as I got older and older, as I recognized what the issues at hand were. And I'll just also add two other little pieces. One, I was a Boy Scout, and we're very much trained to leave our campsite better than it was when we got there. And I think that overall philosophy is one that I'd like to see us apply to the planet as a whole, in every way in which we interact with nature and with natural resources, that we start to look at how can we improve upon and leave this region, this location, this water basin, this resource bank more regenerative as we leave it. And then I'll add, years later, when I was on a trip to India and walking through the cotton fields in India, I had this deep recognition that my family legacy had been in the cotton industry in the South, and that there was a relationship to the negative impacts on not only the environment of the textile industry for hundreds of years, if not thousands, but also and very important on social and labor issues related to workers. And that goes back to the American Deep South. And it also obviously exists still today in some of the issues we face around forced labor and migrant workers and other types of workers globally. So all these things, kind of part of my past, part of my family of origin, part of my natural habitat as a child, all of that, I think, has led me to make this work important.
And you mentioned Cradle to Cradle. At what point did you get involved with circular systems and your work at Cradle to Cradle?
Yeah. So I first heard about the book Cradle to Cradle when I was working at the Clean Air Campaign. It was 2004, I think, was when the book came out, and I was there soon after. But when I got to Mohawk Industries, because the founders of Cradle to Cradle, William McDonough and Michael Bromgart, had been working deeply with various carpet manufacturers from Shaw Industries to Interface to Tandis, Tarquette. They had been working with brands to help design carpet as an input to a circular flow, that products would be technical nutrients that would go back into themselves or into some auxiliary industry. And so it was, I remember getting into that job at Mohawk and starting to make a list of the people that I wanted to meet in the movement. And Bill McDonough was right at the top of that list. And about a year or two into the job, I had the opportunity to meet him. And he was discussing the launching of this institute based in California that would take the Cradle to Cradle standard and scale it globally. And so that was the seed of my learning about the work. And then in 2012, I had kept in touch with some of the folks that were launching the Institute in California, and I approached them about potentially working for them. And what do you know? They had an opening, and so I joined. And then 3 years later, I was running the organization. So it really was kind of kismet, I think, that I envisioned wanting to meet and work with Bill, and that I was able to find myself squarely in the middle of the Cradle to Cradle family and in the work that we were doing.
And for our listeners who are not familiar with the book, or maybe have never even heard of Cradle to Cradle, can you kind of give us a little bit of the nuts and bolts movement and, yeah, maybe how it's affecting your work at Apparel Impact Institute?
Absolutely. So I think, you know, I really encourage your listeners to find out about this book and to grab a copy if they can. The book itself is actually made with plastics that are upcycled and recyclable materials that can go into continuous flow. The concept of Cradle to Cradle is kind of embedded in the name, which means rather than designing products with a linear model of cradle to grave being a landfill, where products are designed without an intention for anything other than what they are. A cell phone is a cell phone. It's only going to be a cell phone. My pair of jeans are a pair of jeans. They're only going to be a pair of jeans. Cradle to Cradle would say, what if we designed with the intention of continuous material flow, continuous reutilization of those materials, and everything goes into a future cycle? Everything is a nutrient for the next system. So it's a design philosophy that was really laid out in this book, Cradle to Cradle, Remaking the Way We Make Things. And the philosophy says everything's a nutrient for a future cycle, just like nature. And if we start to design the impact that humanity has on the planet, looking at ourselves as a subset where everything either goes safely back into the biosphere, compostable, reused, just like the dying carcass of a bird on the ground becomes nutrients for the tree. We want to create that kind of system. And the same for technical nutrients, which would be metals and plastics and petroleum base, that we want to look at them as valuable materials that should not be sent to landfill, but should be designed to go into future flows. And the interesting thing about this is it lays this groundwork for what we call the circular economy, creating an economy where all nutrients and materials actually have value, and they continue to have value as they move forward into future cycles. And in order to evaluate them, we also look at the chemistry, what they're made of. Are they healthy for the system in which they're going to go into? So we might evaluate a cell phone differently than a pair of jeans, or a toy that a baby's going to chew on, different than a computer part. So we start to look at the intended or unintended risk associated with those products and the chemicals and materials in them. And then we also advocate that there's a circularity of all resources, so that all products today and now and in the future should be made with clean, renewable energy, clean, renewable water stewardship, and clean, healthy, available social and labor practices. And so that, in a nutshell, is the Cradle to Cradle philosophy.
And just how close, I mean, you're in the thick of it. I see this more as a consumer, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. that's more my perspective in many ways when I look at the big picture. How close are we to really changing or becoming a circular sure. system?
That's a great question. And I think I didn't answer part of your last question, so yes. I'll start to bring it into this too, because yes. I'll speak now about the apparel. How is this close to what we're doing at Apparel Impact Institute? When I lay out those five areas, we want everything to be healthy and safe. That's green chemistry. We want our chemical management. We want everything to be made so that it has value in future cycles, so we don't create with the intention of waste. That's this piece of circulating materials. We want everything to be built on a clean energy economy so that there's no negative CO2 or greenhouse gas emissions that is impacting the production or the transportation or the retail and selling of these materials. And so it means transitioning the globe over to clean energy. Water the same. Not only do we want to evaluate how much water we're using, how little water we're using, but we also want whatever water we're using to be clean. And obviously the amount of water we use is going to be dependent on different regions. Where there's water scarcity, we want to try to drive innovation towards waterless dyeing systems or, you know, new kind of disruptive ways in which we try not to use water for anything but human need and not tap into it for the manufacturing industry as little as possible. But then in regions where there's abundance of water, we want to ensure that the water is cleaner coming out than it was going in. And then same with the livelihood and social labor piece. So how close are we? Because all five of those areas I just described are critical in fashion. And then AII, Apparel Impact Institute, is funding and scaling project work that touch all of these spaces. And we'll, as we continue to grow, and talk more about that later, our intention is that we identify, validate, and fund projects that are can be measured against goals towards each one of those five areas. How close are we? It's a great question. I think we've moved beyond making it the important conversation into action phase. We're about 10 years into the maturity of the sustainable apparel movement. And with that now comes more attention towards measuring impact. And so the work that we're doing along with a lot of our partners is really leaning into, now we need to ensure that if we're going to fund a project, if we're going to get something scalable, it's going to actually deliver an impact. So there's a lot of initiatives right now that are driving big brand and retailers to make public commitments around this. And if you Google this space, you'll come up with lots of companies saying we're going to be 100% circular by the year 2030, or we're going to reduce our carbon emissions in the supply chain by 30% by 2030. So there's this desire to start to proclaim goals and move toward them. So we are not there. Are we 10 years away? Is 2030 a fair date to put out there as having been complete? I think it's too advanced. I think we can make a lot of headway, and some of it absolutely must be made because it's attached to sort of a science-based approach towards climate impact, et cetera. I think this is the work of our lifetime. I think we're going to see this whole transition happen over the next 20, 30 years, with the next 10 being critical to demonstrate that not only is this the right thing to do, but that we can find new ways in which companies make money along the value chain so that this also flows with economic prosperity. Because if it's seen as not being able to help grow markets, it's going to be very challenging to be able to make the case for selling this into the world's production and consumption model, right? So we have to find ways that we can demonstrate economic value to that. And that's where the work is right now. You'll see that banks and institutional investors are all showing up to figure out those kinds of valuations as well.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we are going to take a quick little song break here. And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about that. I've got a lot of questions for you. This is Heartstock in a Moment. We'll be right back with Lewis Perkins.
Thank you.
This is Heartstock Radio, and today our guest is Lewis Perkins of Apparel Impact Institute. Hi again, Lewis.
Hello again.
So, I do agree with what you were saying before, is that we are living in a time of change, and we must seize the day. Just how close are we? You were talking about that before. Mm-hmm. And how demanding are consumers that this change be made? I mean, I see it being kind of double-edged in that businesses have a responsibility to become more sustainable, but we as consumers also have a responsibility to demand that businesses do this.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
What's your take on all that?
Yeah, you know, the consumer has a really important role in this, because there are a couple key drivers as to what makes a brand retailer do this. One is, if you are still part of your founding origin story, if you are Patagonia and you have Yvonne Chouinard still coming on campus, you know, there's a lot of really important cultural brand identity legacy in companies like that, attached to the environment and the planet, and values that still remain really close to the founding of the company. I mentioned earlier that I came out of the carpet industry. Ray Anderson of Interface very much had that role within the carpet industry of really helping to drive values inside the company. So oftentimes these are companies that are still privately held and they don't have to answer to the market as much. But even if they are publicly traded, they still have some initial DNA in it. They're founded around values related to the planet. And those companies are able to go faster, and also their audience. I hesitate to talk about consumers, because I think we're all trying to rethink the role of the person who has a relationship to the brand and purchases their products as a citizen. So I'll kind of refer to them as the citizen. But I think the citizen who purchases from these companies very much is aligned with those values, and they have a following based on it. Stella McCartney, Eileen Fisher, you know, these are companies where their patrons care about these things more. Then you have other companies that it may not really be on the radar of most of their audience, like the target guest. Is the majority of the target guest thinking about the planet? Walmart, same thing. You know, and many are, and many of them care, but when it comes down to it, price is the most important thing to them. And if it's between a dollar difference on a product or a pair of pants or a shirt or something, they may not make that leap. But if we also look to other industries that have been able to do this successfully, like organic dairy and other types of organic foods and vegetables in the food and agriculture space, then we do sometimes see it. Then I would say the other key driver is just the inherent risk. You know, I don't want, as a CEO, I don't want people picketing and petitioning outside of my retail space or my corporate headquarters because they find out that we've done something bad in the supply chain of Bangladesh or China or Italy, you know. A couple of years back, the disastrous collapse of the Rana Plaza production facility in Bangladesh had a huge impact, because so many Western brands were attached to that production center and where their clothing was being produced there. A lot of them didn't even know it, because their supply chain was so complex that might have been further down the supply chain. And all they knew was who was assembling the garment at the end, but they didn't know who was making the yarn, or they didn't know who was dyeing the fabric. So risk is a big one. So consumer, yes. Risk, definitely. And risk has a lot to do with your stock price, your goodwill, and your overall perceived brand as well, which comes back to the valuation of your company and your audience base who comes and purchases your products. And then I think the final one is, you know, really around the environmental impacts itself. So you really do have companies who also are looking at the inherent risk associated with just those environmental impacts. And they're looking at where the spiking price of organic cotton or just conventional cotton during droughts could actually cause them to have economic risk. So it's not a public perception risk like I talked about in number two. It's more of a, this could disrupt our pricing and our economic model risk. risk. And I think more and more companies are looking at climate change, water scarcity, human health. They're looking at these issues, like what we're going through right now with the coronavirus and how that's impacting and costing manufacturing in Asia. And so these things are going to become increasingly critical to the bottom line and to hit the bottom line. So to your question about consumers, I think consumers play a huge role in this, because if the tides change and more citizens stop purchasing from a company because they don't meet the values of that citizen, then it becomes an inherent risk. And all three of those things I just talked about really do play into public perception. And I think oftentimes if you look at some of the research or data that's coming from the Natural Marketing Institute and the sector that we call LOHAS, Lifestyles of Health and Sustainability, at least in America, the citizens who are more concerned about climate, more willing to align their purchasing power toward companies that share their values, has been dramatically increasing over the last 10 to 15 years. And I think that is going to only increase with the younger generations who are now coming into their own purchasing power and share common values, because they've only grown up in a world where we've had environmental issues. And so that's going to mean that this is even more pressing to them as they start to think about how they spend their money.
So we've got maybe about three minutes left. And I was hoping in this time you could give our listeners an example of an initiative and the impact that's having, that you're currently working on or that you've worked on before.
Great. I would love to share that. So as I shared earlier, our mission is to identify, fund, scale, and measure impact solutions. So that means that oftentimes what we try to do is look for areas that need to be funded to scale. And so ideally we find programs that are working but just haven't yet gotten to that critical mass. So our first key program that we're working on is called Mill Impact, and it was designed in part by a couple of different organizations, but one of the leader organizations that started it was the NRDC, Natural Resources Defense Council, out of Washington, D.C., and Dr. Linda Greer on their team. And Linda had started the initiative to go create water and energy optimizations or efficiencies and improvements in the wet processing function of manufacturing. And so what this meant was the dye houses. This is where our fabric gets dyed into the colors that we all want and seek each season. But with that is a lot of heat. There are boilers that boil the water, that boil the fabrics to get the dyes to set, that are burning coal. And that's a high CO2 emitting greenhouse gas activity. They're using a lot of energy and they're using a lot of water. And so what this program was designed to do was to create best practices to create greater efficiencies. And what we found was these programs can yield at a minimum 10% carbon dioxide, CO2 reductions over the first 18 months, 40% water savings in many cases. And then because the water and energy bills go down or they're utilizing less resources, they can save up to $400,000 U.S. dollar equivalent per mill per facility over the first 18 to 24 months.
Just
so
good
we're
business.
Scaling that work. Yeah. I mean, it's like it kind of makes no sense. It's a relatively inexpensive program. And so what we're doing is aligning all of the technical providers out there, all of the nonprofits that are running similar programs, and we're aligning them around this is a common set of best practices we can deploy. We can recruit brands and manufacturers under a common strategy, same price point, same measurements, same input output. Mm-hmm. And if we can scale that globally, we'll have a tremendous amount of impact. It's also the first step in getting to clean energy.
Yes. And we have come to the end once again. How might our listeners find you and reach you if they want to carry on the conversation?
For sure. Well, we have a website, if I can share what that is.
That's
it's
awesome.
apparelimpact.org. And you can find us and you can find me on LinkedIn. And I'm actually really happy to talk to people. So find me and send me a note if you have something of interest that you'd like to talk about with me.
Fantastic. This is Heartstock Radio. And we will see you again next week. Peace.
on the sign it said, no trespass.
Heartstock Radio is a production of KBMF 102.5 Butte America Radio. Hear our live programs every Friday at 5 p.m. Mountain Standard Time via live stream at butteamericaradio.org.